has contributed to now looking at their own sex roles. I think, though, that a great deal of what women's liberation in this country has meant has, while it has contributed very definitely and very deeply to the self-confidence and to the more positive image of women, that it has not considered a very, very strong element that is affecting the woman's image and affecting simultaneously the man's image. And that is something that we'll be calling men's liberation or the problems of masculinity. Let me illustrate some of the connections that I'll be doing throughout my presentation between what is now called women's liberation and the new masculinity or the new masculine consciousness. Right now, women's liberation has for a long period of time contributed in a very serious way to the problems of the image of women. The image of women has been a major women's liberation issue. Now, the National Organization for Women has done a study of the image of women, and they've found little girls in textbook, children's book after children's book, saying, "Even I know that, and I'm just a stupid girl." Or stories in which boys in these children's books that are still being used in 1973 saying, "Girls' advice isn't worth 2 cents. Yours isn't worth a penny." NOW's study of 134 children's books documented hundreds of stories with this type of orientation, a theme showing the stupidity of girls. This argument, I think, has a great deal of validity as a women's liberation issue. But what has been missed until this point in time has been that it is also a men's liberation issue. It has stopped one step short of addressing itself in this direction. As a result of this negative image of women, I've seen many boys who want to consider themselves more than anything at the age of 5 and 6, a real boy, afraid to do anything that he feels will make him appear like a girl. Anything that he feels will make him appear like a sissy is something that he gets away from, keeps away from, because the last thing that a boy wants to be called as he's going through his adolescence is effeminate or feminine. And I think it's this negative image of women that creates the boys at a very early age an underlying contempt for women. I believe that this underlying contempt leads boys into having to prove themselves masculine as opposed to feminine. So boys, even in grammar school and high school, compete with other boys because boys are the only ones that they feel are really worth competing with or really worth winning against. And this competition is really to prove themselves a man, more of a man than the other guy. And the competition lasts throughout a man's life, as all of us know. It's okay for a male manager to lose out to another man if that man is really good. But he can't face losing out to another woman unless the government forced it down his throat in an affirmative action program. But his basic attitude is that he doesn't deserve, or he shouldn't, because of his breadwinning role, lose out to a woman. I think once this connection between men's and women's liberation is recognized, I think the men's liberation movement has to do more than just point it out. I think we have to start a network of nationwide consciousness-raising groups, or a network of groups raising people's awareness throughout the country to make them more aware of the fact that this image not only is an image that it's easy for an individual man to overcome, that all of society is putting pressure on him to keep living this image in the way that he's learned to live it. I think that a men's liberation movement also has to become eventually an activist movement. It has to become a movement that presses suggestions for pictures in children's books of men caring for children, not just pictures of women becoming astronauts or presidents or executives. That's presuming that women's liberation means women coming up to where men are. I think what we've got to start realizing is that men's liberation is men being able to learn from women and seeing some of the real values and contributions that women, even in their traditional role, have contributed to the society. I think a men's liberation movement has to start demonstrating for men being staffing elementary schools, for men staffing child care centers. So many women's liberation persons have said, we have to start child care centers. And implicit in that is it's going to be more jobs for women. But from the child perspective, it's more jobs for women staffing child care centers. If it's exclusively women staffing them, basically means the reinforcement of the image of women as the parent and as the sole parent, which is one of the fundamental problems with children in the United States today. We have to press for men, pictures of men changing diapers, pictures of men wearing aprons, pictures of men crying, pictures of men being warm, touching, feeling, and the thousands of things that overcome the male image, but can only overcome that male image if the man is not afraid of appearing like a woman, and therein lies the connection to women's liberation. I think the second reason that women's and men's liberation is connected came to me about a year and a half ago when a woman called me out from Staten Island, New York. And she said, Warren, I've been a member of a women's consciousness raising group for about 6 months now. I'm married for 7 years. I have 3 children. She said, I've had these children for a long period of time. I love my husband, but I've been going away from him during the 3 months or 6 months that I've been a member of this women's consciousness raising group. Every time I come home to my husband, he says, you know, where are the things today? Oh, you can not get any of these things. Okay, we're going to be waiting for things to go out of that problem. And it's a constant harassment that she receives. The more reinforcement she obtains from the group, the more harassment she receives at home. He said, Warren, 6 months ago, I had a nice marriage. I've grown a great deal since then. And every bit of my growth has been a separation for all practical purposes from my husband. I literally sometimes can't stand this man anymore. And she said, can I get him to come and speak with some of the men in his consciousness raising group that we've been holding for about a year at that time? We tried getting him to come and he said, oh no, I don't want anything with that, you know, type of women's liberation stuff. You people aren't in favor of that. I don't want anything to do with it. It was back and forth for a long period of time. Eventually, she wrote me that she and her husband had gotten into a fight where he had literally chased her around the house with a knife, threatening to kill her, kill himself, and kill the children. And time again, I've seen women's liberation, where the woman is growing and the man is stagnating, lead to the man and the woman growing apart and not having any ability to communicate with each other and get together. What I am suggesting is not a cessation of women's liberation consciousness raising groups, the solution to that. I'm suggesting a beginning of men's consciousness raising groups. But I also don't think that long time men's groups meeting separately accomplish as much of a purpose and have as much of a positive function as men's groups meeting separately for about 3 months, and then women's groups meeting separately for about 3 months, and then meeting alternately together and alternately separately. This is something that I'll talk about in some detail after the panel this afternoon, and it's something that I've addressed to some extent in the Ms. Magazine article that's out on this issue. So I won't spend a great deal of time focusing on it now. But I did want to get across the basic point that I see this movement having to grow, if it's ever going to expand to people in the country at large, having to grow to be a two-sex movement, not with men standing up there saying, my dear, this is your problem, and has had their own problem as well. Okay, but how, what does advanced consciousness raising group do? What are the problems that it runs into? How does a man attempt in this culture to overcome what we call today the masculine mystique, and what some people perhaps more accurately call the masculine mystique? A men's consciousness raising group is literally a group of about 7 or 8 men who sit around in a circle and try to raise their consciousness or raise their awareness of the things that they're doing in their life, the decisions that they're making that are based on their images of themselves that are related to masculinity as opposed to the type of thing that women's groups do, which is the same basic thing, but it has to be in relation to femininity. When we started this group about 2.5 years ago, I'd say that perhaps there was not a man in the group who had ever learned how to listen. There was not a man in the group who learned how to listen to other men or learned how to listen to other women. As we started talking about who our closest male friends were, we realized that since the 2/3 of us that had graduated from college and graduated, there was not one of us who had really obtained a close male friend since our graduation from college. And that even our close college friends were based on some dubious types of relationships that we were now beginning to question, such as an interest in sports, or a common interest in going into law, or a common interest in some type of business or profession. Once in our group, we broke down what I call these male crutches of being able to discuss sports and business and profession. We had nothing else to discuss. We did a lot of talking, but we couldn't talk personally with each other. I had just finished my doctoral orals, and I was the master at intellectualizing. I didn't know how to personalize. I didn't know how to talk about myself, and talk about myself in a way that admitted weaknesses. Few of us in the group knew how to sympathize in any real way, and none of us knew how to empathize in a way that was meaningful. We were all, in a sense, caught up in defining our manhood as getting to a higher step on the different ladders that we had chosen to specialize in and to prove ourselves an adequate man. We were constantly worried when we came back from our job whether we had sort of made it or whether our supervisors had approved of us this time. And this constant need to have approval from somebody higher than us on this ladder made us unable to admit we were wrong to that person on the ladder and kept us teaching ourselves all the time how to keep our weaknesses to ourselves, how to shield ourselves and protect ourselves from criticism, how to build up an expertise in our job so that we could claim we knew something better than anybody else. And so in that area, which was a function of our life, we could not be questioned. And once we had built up that expertise, we realized that we were afraid to even walk next door to ask a question to somebody that exposed our ignorance to them in that area. And these were the male weaknesses that prevented us from the group from saying anything about something that had reflected poorly on us in our job. The first time I took my doctoral orals, that's the first time I took my doctoral written exams, I failed. It took me a year in the group to admit that, because that was a reflection on, it appears it was a reflection of my intelligence, it was a reflection of my masculinity, my ability to show that I was the type of breadwinner that, and the type of man that other men and other women could respect. We found ourselves in the group interrupting each other, constantly trying to overcome each other's points. One man would make a point, another man would make a point. discover the condescending way that we were saying it. Or as soon as the conversation got serious and somebody started pointing to an error that we were making, we find ourselves joking as an escape mechanism. Sort of, oh, well, isn't it funny that, or, no, gee, isn't it cute that you know, society really does this to us? It wasn't society only that did it to us. Yes, it was society that helped us learn it, but it was ourselves perpetuating it. And it was much easier to joke than to face that aspect of ourselves. Men have learned, I believe, to manipulate other men into listening, but we've spent very little time in our lives to manipulate ourselves into listening and paying attention and into respecting others. I'd like to mention four experiments that we've tried in our groups, in our joint consciousness raising groups in particular, the groups that meet with women, that we found very successful and very important indicators of how far both the men and the women have come toward developing an independent and considerate way of talking and communicating with each other. One is an experiment that I'll call dominance timing. Dominance timing is done by somebody just taking out a watch when nobody else is aware that they're doing it. And when the conversation gets serious, timing the amount that the men speak and timing the amount that the women speak during that conversation. Just a simple timing. We did this the first time as sort of a joke on the part of one of the men. When we had met with a group of seven now women, and we were a group of seven men who were in one way or another associated with women and men. And the timing resulted in the men speaking 18 minutes for every 1 minute that the women spoke. This is our liberated people. The amazing thing, though, was not the dominance. The amazing thing was the excuses they gave after we discovered this. All of the men in the group said, you know, well, we know a lot about the subject. The women in the group said, in fact, you do know a lot about the subject. You know much more about the subject than you know. The subject was employment. A woman had come into the group and presented her problem of discrimination in employment. And all of the men took turns solving her problem for her. We then went around the group to see if we were right on this, to see whether we were being unfair to ourselves. We asked every woman in the group, or one of the women suggested we ask every woman in the group what she could contribute to that problem without the men interrupting and talking. With the exception of one woman in the group, every woman had a contribution that she could make, and every woman had an experience that could have contributed to helping that first woman solve the problem. And yet none of us either allowed through the dominance pattern the opportunity for the woman to speak, and the woman also contributed to the same feeling by feeling that she, her contribution was not valuable enough, and she didn't want to play the male game, which was of interrupting other people, and so therefore she would sort of wait until maybe somebody asked her privately, or just not make the contribution at all. Dominance timing is a very, very interesting experiment to see how far men and women are able to communicate with each other. The second experiment is might be called self-listening. This can be done by watching the men's faces when they are speaking. When the men are speaking and they finish speaking, and then a woman starts speaking, watch the man's face when he is supposed to be listening. See if his listening is really a type of listening that's going, yeah. Oh, you know, it's the same thing that I did last year. And when I did that, you know, this happened to me. And he listens for about a moment, gets the gist of what the other person is saying, transfers to his own type of story understand the problem better, but in fact is impressing the group with his ability to have knowledge in that area or his relationship to that. Self-listening is a problem that women also engage in, but if you watch the men and the women, I think you'll find the men do it considerably more frequently than the women do. And it's a type of problem that is fundamental to men's and women's liberation, because it's a type of problem that reinforces the contempt that men have for women and the lack of self-respect that women have for themselves. Because men miss all the subtleties that the women and other men are saying while they're trying to form their own stories and their own ideas as to what is the best answer, the best problem, the best solution to the problem. A third area is really related to self-listening, and it's called man the problem solver. In the 18 to 1 timing that we had, when we did this timing over and over again, we found that it wasn't just that the men were dominating the group, but it was also that when women were speaking, the women were not making statements for the most part. They were asking questions. And their questions were directed at the men. And the men were spending the time answering their questions. Frequently their answers were directed at the other men. And the argument was between the two men, but the women were just like the cheerleaders in a football team. They were sort of the judges, and they were the supporters, and they were sort of, you know, evaluating which man was making the best contribution to the solving of the problem. And that can be picked up in a consciousness raising group or in a mixed group by just watching what the content of each person's, you know, contribution to the group is. And it's frequently the woman asking the question and the man answering the question. And the most subtle, but I think the most important area, is the area of the fourth experiment, which is topic security. And that is that frequently in this type of group, the man will do a fundamental thing of gives him the advantage. He'll move, and the woman will help the man do this as well. The topic will move to an area that the man is most comfortable in. So my wife is a computer systems manager, and I'm in political science. And inevitably, in a group where the four of us, two of us plus four or six other people are sitting around and talking, the area will tend to move into politics. Unless it's somebody else with computers there, it's a man, then it will often move into a balance between politics and computers. And until we were aware of this, we thought it was natural that I should contribute more to the conversation because I didn't know more about politics than my wife did. But that was one of the fundamental underlying errors in the conversation, that we moved into an area that I felt most comfortable in, and therefore that I would feel right about dominating in. And that's very, very seldom picked up unless you're aware of it, because again, women contribute to saying, you know, gee, that's really good, you really must do, you know, you really must know a lot of that area. Sort of walking, catering to the man, and the man just feeding right back into that. And the fundamental problem is that men, once this occurs, are put under pressure to have a solution to their problems all the time. They can never say, gee, I don't know that. They can never learn from somebody else. They can never really listen. Even though topic security is an important thing to pick out in these types of joint groups in any mixed conversation, we found that even when in our mixed groups we were talking about the areas that the women in our groups knew the most about, areas like child raising, areas like, you know, raising children, the men still dominated the conversation in these areas and still provided more of the solutions to how children should be raised, even in areas that the women in the group have been trained in and have been experienced in more than the men. I think this dominance and this inability to admit weakness is really the first sin of masculinity, which might be termed the command, thou shalt not be vulnerable. And the corollary of that commandment, commandments and corollaries, is just an inability to come close to somebody with whom you might have to admit weakness and admit vulnerability. Right, if men's attitudes toward women are going to change, what types of things do men have to overcome? What types of things change their attitudes most effectively? And what types of things ultimately change their behavior? These are the fundamental questions that I posed to myself 3 years ago when I started to do a study of men's attitudes. And what I basically did is I presented 17 articles in women's liberation literature to a group of 250 men, literally random samples of men and a lot of other sub-samples of the population. And I found there were two types of myths that had to be solved before men could even begin to sort of consider the whole topic of breaking down sex roles seriously. One type of myth I call factual myths, and the other type self-fulfilling myths. The self-fulfilling myth is really the more devastating type of myth. You know what a self-fulfilling myth is. It's basically you start out saying something like women are the weaker sex, women are the dependent sex, and then you do everything all during your life to fulfill that prophecy that women have weaker sex and more dependent sex. For example, studies have been shown that by Goldberg and Lewis that when women and men who are parents are sitting in the living room and their boy child is crying, they will allow the boy child to cry for a longer period of time before picking it up than they will the girl child. They are assuming at the age of 2 or 3 days that the boy child can solve its own problems and the girl child cannot solve its own problems. They are reinforcing the girl at that age when she cries and when she expresses fear or when she expresses weakness that she will be taken care of, she will be paid attention to. But when the boy child cries, unless it really is a lot of crying, that he can solve his own problem, that he doesn't need to be catered to in the same way. At the end of a month, at the end of 2 months, at the end of a half a year, the parents proudly take you in and say, see how independent my boy child is, and see what the difference is between him and the girl next door. And it's assumed that these weaknesses and this dependence and independence are natural, as opposed to that we as parents could not possibly have had anything to do with contributing to it. In fact, consciously, they did not. That's an example of self-fulfilling myth, and yet the self-fulfilling myth is constantly maintained by a whole series of factual myths. One of the most convenient things to do in maintaining myths that literally can be disproven by presenting other facts is closing our eyes to places like Sweden, where 75% of the crane operators are women, or to Romania, where 40,000 women hold political office, or to Czechoslovakia, where 70% of the district judges are women, to say nothing of some of the differences in roles that are assumed in places like Israel, the Soviet Union, and Cuba. In none of these countries are women's roles and men's roles ideal. But one of the values of looking to some of these countries is that we can see that they are at least different. And if they can be different there, there's probably less of a natural reason why they can't be different here. And it gives us more hope for changing. Once men recognize these factual myths, they tend to be able to open themselves up to examining the way they're explaining them and the way they're carrying out the sex roles a little bit more easily. Over and over again, women contribute to to what ends up being men's insecurity. Women are frequently, especially as I teach, I see women constantly doing this to men, they're frequently building up men's egos. And in the process of building up men's egos, they're building up one large, fragile, and insecure instrument. Probably the second largest, fragile, most insecure instrument that men have. But I think the woman who is constantly dogging after incessant questions as to, that's really great that you're going to be a lawyer, or that's really great that you're going to be, you know, a principal of a school, not just a teacher, or that's really great that you're going to make a lot of money, or, you know, what are you going to do next year? Wow, you finished your master's in a year. This type of admiration is a type of admiration that reinforces in men the needs that constantly have to keep producing. And it also reinforces in men the inability to admit weakness and to admit fault when they do fail. Or the inability to just say, you know, I think I'm going to take 3 years to do my master's because I think I would enjoy it more doing it that way. Or I think I'm going to take off from work a year because I think I would enjoy doing something else that isn't as productive monetarily. I think that weakness, that inability to admit weakness, transfers to not only men's breadwinning role, but also to men's inability to relate to women in a warm and an open way. I think once men reach this stage, I think it's also important to start addressing not how women's liberation in its present form threatens men, and not how men's liberation is a retaliatory force against women, but rather how women's and men's liberation really work very much together and how both of them benefit each other. I'd like to give you a few examples of that, which I found to be the more misunderstood things that I ran across as I was doing my interviews in these 250 men. The first type of complaint that I would get from men as I did interviews was that men would say, the divorce rate now, if we keep up all this women's liberation stuff, the divorce rate's going to increase, and things are going to be much worse than they are before, and we're going to get my children, and so on. And yet the same man who's talking about the divorce rate growing is doing the type of thing by concentrating only on his labor and his job. He is doing the type of thing that is dividing himself away from his wife and woman friend. And he is doing the type of thing that is forcing his woman friend to spend all of her time taking care of the children and working on just her type of labor. In other words, the man and the woman have worked past the point of diminishing returns. He at his job and her at taking care of the children. To the extent that you can actually see this division occur in any living room situation, where after polite types of introductions are finished with, the men are sitting in one corner talking about one thing, and the women are sitting in another grouping talking about another thing. And that division of labor tends to lead to the division of interests. And that division of interests creates that abyss between men and women that is then solved by them saying to each other, no, I think there's something missing in our marriage. I think perhaps we should have something else needs to come in to fulfill it. I think maybe the reason, honey, that you're not fulfilled is because we don't have any children. And children are put in as a fulfillment type of device. Obviously, this is not always the reason for children, but it's too frequently one of the contributing factors for bringing about children. And it's often, and the perfect, almost proof of this is looking at the statistical divorce rate increase at the end of 25 years, which soars again. When the children have grown and gone away to college, then the man and woman take their focus off of the children, which have been the sort of central problem all along, so to speak, and start looking at each other again and realizing, and sometimes realizing, that they're deploying each other. of exploration and working together will actually decrease, or at least when they increase, it will be for the right reasons of people being able to get divorced and being secure and not holding on to each other out of insecurity or out of my inability to have a job in another area. Another example you can use of men complaining about the effect of immigration is, I remember a vice president of the family saying, "Now listen, don't tell me that women don't have power. My wife controls everything. She controls me, she controls the children, she controls the wedding, she controls the home, she controls everything. How can you say women should not have power? How can you say that women shouldn't have more power?" And yet the same man should have more power. And yet the same man is the man who is so willing to keep women in the type of position where they only have one thing to control. And I would suggest that any human being who only has one small area to control is going to end up controlling that area to such an extent that it will be oppressive. And it's the same type of thing that men do with their jobs and with their specializations, is they hang on for dear life and they can over-control them. And they over-control their employees, and they do everything to try to expand their power base. And any man that has to live vicariously through his job is doing that, just like as any woman who has to live vicariously for her children and her husband. So the same nagging, petty wife that this man was complaining about, him nagging, was the type of woman that could be eliminated, or could be the type of attitude of the part of woman that could be eliminated by reorienting his own thinking, his own behavior in more grand sense. The third complaint that I would get from men, especially employers, was the constant complaint that, listen, I'm oppressed in my job too. I have a lot of pressures on me. Don't just talk about women's liberation. And in fact, I think that man has a point. Many men are oppressed in their jobs too. But I think that what women's has to offer is a much greater decrease in that oppression. When I've spent a great deal of time during the last 4 years working, sitting, listening to the problems that my wife had at work, talking them out with her, that time spent on her economic independence has helped me to be able to say and do the types of things on my job that I want to do. It has made my job less oppressive. It has enabled me as a political scientist, for example, to study sex roles. And the political science community studying sex roles is looked at as being, anathema. It has enabled me to speak up on my job, because I know that if I lose my job, I don't have the sole responsibility for breadwinning. That my wife shares the responsibility, and if I lose it, we don't starve at the same time. I've seen many radicals graduate from college and suddenly put their radicalism underneath their shirt because, I have a job, I have family to support, and I have children to support, and I can't speak up now. I've got to wait until I get to the top of the business or the top of the academic ladder before I can speak up, because otherwise I'll lose my job. And as long as they are taking the sole responsibility for breadwinning, that will always be a type of oppression that they will have. Part of what I'm saying is that the family, I believe, can grow considerably closer together as a result of women's and men's liberation. That the family does not have to be broken apart. This does not mean that we should not be seeking alternative arrangements such as communes, alternative arrangements and alternative options such as child care centers. What it does mean is that any heterosexual, and I believe ultimately homosexual unit, will have a better chance of surviving if there is this increase in communication and lapse and doing away with the stereotyping that are forcing people to be driven away from each other. One of the things that has also happened in a lot of families with children, when both parents are sharing responsibility for breadwinning, decides that he doesn't want to do a lot of the cooking, and they eat out in restaurants more frequently. And this is an interesting phenomenon because the children, when they're eating out in restaurants, find they are for the first time able to talk to both their parents as adults, and as sort of almost an equal type of, not as adults, but sort of on an equal type of level. And the woman who used to be serving the meals in the house is not seen by the children as a servant who has to get up to get more salt, to get more napkins, to get more food, to serve the next course, and therefore cannot participate in conversations in any meaningful way, which reinforces the contempt that the young boy and young girl has for children, are obtained from children at a very early age, at least in some of the problems that I mentioned at the outset. I think that this freedom to question on the job is also very fundamental to overcoming one of the major problems of the business world and the capitalist system today, and that is the leverage that the business world has on individual men to stay on their jobs because of the security that job offers. And I think that once that leverage on the part of the business community is gone, there's a lot more questioning, a lot more fresh air can be introduced to corporations. This is all somewhat attitudinal in discussion, and it's also personal behavior. I think personal behavior is a level that men's consciousness creates through, and a men's liberation movement has to start discussing. But there's also a lot of institutional changes that have to be examined simultaneously with changes in personal behavior. One of these is work on child care centers. And people usually think when they think of child care centers as only government-sponsored or city-sponsored child care centers. But I've seen a lot of child care centers start just by informal exchanges of children. Unfortunately, it's too frequently among women, but ultimately, we have to start these informal exchanges of children among both parents, with both parents taking part of that responsibility. There's also a great deal of work that is being done now, and some of which is already published, on child care centers and places of employment. And experience with that area shows that it's one of the very few economic fringe benefits that companies can offer that gives a direct return in benefit to the company. Because frequently now it's the woman who is being trained by the company for a certain job. Anyone who knows anything about the economics of training knows that it costs a great deal to train an employee. And that they lose that woman because of turnover. And companies that are installing child care centers can claim that to be a fringe benefit for employees, which is actually a very essential benefit. But at the same time, it prevents so much of the turnover that occurs by many of these companies in the employment area. Child care centers, by the way, I think have to be looked at very definitely as something that both parents can bring their children to. And so therefore, you have two jobs that should be being pressured, two companies, or two areas of employment should be being pressured for instituting child care centers in that area. Too frequently, the man says, okay, honey, why don't we try to get your university or your business to have a child care center, when he should be making just as much effort to do it in his area of business. And it would be a good opportunity for the boy and girl children to commute in back and forth to the child care center with the man or with the father during the day, and the father therefore at one time with the child. I think other changes have to be brought about, that can be brought about that open up more options are changes such as the 4-day work week. And a lot of factories are beginning to find a 4-day work week very beneficial and very economical. Other series of changes are such things as staggered hours. When you start putting staggered hours and 4-day work weeks and child care centers together, you start increasing your flexibility to arrange for child care. And when you start talking not just in terms of women's responsibility for child care, but women's and men's responsibility of the child here, you add an additional variable, an additional alternative for that child care, which I think is very important. I think there's also a whole series of changes that have to be brought about by the men's liberation movement. Some of these are establishing a nationwide network of men's consciousness raising groups, which will ultimately become joint consciousness raising groups of men and women meeting alternately, one week as all men and all women, and then one week together. I think we have to start protesting book publishers, not just for not picturing women in the role such as President and Astronaut, as I mentioned before, but also for not picturing men in the type of men's roles that we discussed before. We have to start pressing in universities, the University of Iowa, for courses not just on women's studies, but courses on sex role studies. Women's studies imply that it's a woman's problem, and it's, when in fact it's a man's problem as well. We have to start passing out literature in football games, protesting much of what football means and what its implications are for sexism and masculinity. We have to start making men more aware of what they toss off down as being meaningless, and that is more aware of sex and objectivism. And one of the ways that has been very effective is conducting consciousness-raising experiments such as men's beauty contests. When a man is involved in a beauty contest, let me tell you, something happens. We did this in our consciousness-raising group, and for weeks beforehand, I found myself looking in the mirror, watching, whether my beard was growing in too high, too low, whether it was trimmed right, finding myself doing push-up for the first time in years. A whole series of things that I considered I had outgrown. But when I knew people were going to judge me on that basis, I suddenly started becoming much more aware of it. And my ease in saying women should just not cater to that became a much deeper understanding of the pressures on the part of women that women receive, and the pressures that men could possibly have received to become sex objects in society. It also made me even more acutely aware of what I call the isolationist fallacy, which is thinking that it's so easy to change all by yourself without recognizing the societal pressure on you to stay the way you are. So we have to start demonstrating, I think, for equal standing of what are now called women's jobs with men, as well as equal staffing of men's jobs with women. And that means equal staffing of child care centers with men. It means we have to be pressing for quotas, and I hate quotas for a lot, I think, very important reasons, but sometimes they're the only ways to accomplish things in society. We have to start pressing for women, for men being involved in elementary school teaching, for men being involved as nurses, for men being involved taking care of children in the home, for men being involved as stewards in airlines, for men being involved as teachers, and the whole series of occupations which are now considered women's occupations. And as long as they're considered women's occupations, they will maintain the low pay, the disrespect, and the contempt that they now hold. These are the changes that have to occur at a societal level, but some of the most difficult changes to bring about are changes in the personal level. And I just want to conclude what I'm saying with a few anecdotes of how difficult it is to change on the personal level. Men are constantly involved in wanting to change, but when they change, wanting to do dramatic changes. I can remember men wanting to, they said, oh, I'll get involved in cooking. And they got involved in cooking, all right. But it was one meal a week. And it was a gourmet meal. And it was a meal that they could finish off saying, I am really a good cook to my wife. You know that? And they were a better cook than their wife because they we tend to like, we tend to learn from our very early childhood that we as men are worthy of making the dramatic changes, but that the routine changes and the routine things, the women take care of that. And that's one of the things that, in a personal way, has to be overcome by men in consciousness raising groups. Also, we suffered under the illusion for a long period of time that changes were very simple to make. Changes in behavior were very simple to make. When in fact, even the simplest changes that we would agree to in consciousness raising groups were often very difficult to implement in real life. One of the things that in our first group meeting, we all got together and we thought, well, gee, all right, if we had agreed at that point, which we disagree with now, that, okay, some of our wives naturally love cooking. Okay. And, but that if we're going to be liberated, that we should at least clean up after the meal, at least take the dishes into the kitchen, after the meal is finished with. Okay, first stage of liberation. One might begin to call liberation. And so we had six of us sitting around the table, three men and three women, all attached to each other, we're all middle class heterosexual, unification. And we, at the end of the dinner, the women automatically stood up and started eating off the table. And the men and we all continued our conversation. And I suddenly realized, gee, last week I promised I was supposed to get up and clean off the table. So I started picking up the rest of I took a few of the dishes in. As I got into the kitchen and came out again and took another group of dishes out, the woman next to me said, gee, Joe, it's really nice to have a husband like Warren, cleaning up all these dishes. Why don't you do something like that? And the man looked at me and said, Warren, what right are you trying to do? And I was standing between the kitchen and that table, wondering whether I should keep taking the dish back into the room, or whether I should take the dish back out to the table. And knowing that when I took the dish out to the room, I was going to be called a girl's boy, or a woman's liberation boy, or a man with aprons on. And knowing that if I sat back down, I was going to be called a male chauvinist pig. And the very simplest of changes, which I presume was anybody could do, I began to feel the pressure of trying to do something in isolation. And eventually what this began to bring about was our slowly cutting off friends that could not accept our living a slightly different lifestyle than we were living. And so now I speak to audiences.
Dishwasher.
realize they spent 5 minutes talking women's talk. Some of those gains are statistical gains, like having less holes.